Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of December 3rd, 2019. This week, we look at the controversial world of magistrate judges in South Carolina. These judges wield life-changing powers, but most of them don't even have law degrees. They undergo less training than police officers and barbers, and some have remained on the bench despite disciplinary actions. We talk with the Post and Courier's Joe Cranny about his investigation with ProPublica about this secretive world with limited oversight. Also, interact with us on Twitter or Instagram at SCLeadPod. We always want to hear from you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. Make sure you subscribe to us on iTunes, where you can also rate and review us. And we're everywhere podcasts exist, including NPR One. You can listen to all four sections of our podcast instead of freaking out about your holiday shopping, since there's one less week to do it this year. You know what the best gift is, though? A review of The Lead on iTunes. You know, everyone in the family wants one of those reviews. Review it, screenshot it, give it as a present. Or while you look for flights to South Korea in anticipation of the forthcoming Wu-Tang Clan theme park. Ooh, boy. That's another great present right there. Once Kim Jong-un finds out about this theme park, I'm pretty sure we're going to have reunification on the peninsula. Wow, Merry Christmas. And now for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present. But here in the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, the Associated Press reports that Governor Henry McMaster has decided not to nominate Public Safety Department Director Leroy Smith to a third term, ending a tenure that included fights with lawmakers over trooper morale and claims of mismanagement. In a statement to reporters, Smith defended his eight-year tenure, pointing out he raised pay, got safer and better equipment for his officers, and successfully protected the state in a series of natural disasters. McMaster's statement gave no reason why he did not renominate Smith. Number two, the state newspaper reports that South Carolina utility regulators will investigate Dominion Energy's sale of customer data to a third-party company that has been accused of deceptive marketing tactics in a number of other states. Dominion says it has temporarily stopped sharing customers' data with HomeServe USA, the home repairs company that has been sending those customers unsolicited mailers suggesting that they purchase insurance on the gas lines in their homes. Number three, hurricane season came to a close on November 30th. Never forget Red Jeep. The 2019 season saw 18 named storms, 6 were hurricanes, and 3 were major hurricanes, which was above average as predicted. Hurricane Dorian was our biggest threat in early September. The Category 2 storm skirted the coast, causing some beach erosion and spawned several tornadoes in Horry County, but for the most part, it spared major damage to the state. Number 4, the Post and Courier reports that the state Democratic Party and two national Democratic campaign organizations have sued the state election commission over a long-standing state law that requires prospective voters to submit their full Social Security number in order to register to vote. The groups argue that the requirement has an unconstitutional chilling effect on potential voters who are concerned about sharing Social Security numbers, something that is mandated in only 4 states nationwide. A spokesman for the commission said the agency does not comment on pending litigation, and state Republicans framed the lawsuit as an attempt by Democrats to, quote, change the rules because they know they can't win at the ballot box. Most states only ask for 4 digits of a voter's Social Security number or other identifying information. And now for our Florida Man News segment. Each week we give you a headline, a taste of the most captivating Florida Man news. Here's a little travel edition one. TSA, Florida man caught with loaded gun at airport. Again. Leave it at home, Dave. Leave it at home. And like those Auburn fans who got stuck in the bushes while trying to storm the field after their win over Alabama, we bury the lead. Oh, Saban. Saban's tears. This year, we've had several episodes dealing with the criminal justice system in South Carolina, thanks to great reporters in the state. And here are some things to be wary of, and we're adding a new one to this list. Be wary of having large amounts of cash on you should you get pulled over and without probable cause have it confiscated by local law enforcement. Be wary of having a mental illness, especially in Greenville County, where law enforcement shootings occur at a higher rate than in other parts of the state. Be wary of electing the wrong sheriff because they may defraud you by using your tax dollars to pay for their junkets or act above the law. Be wary of circuit court judges in South Carolina that have been disciplined. Oh wait, you can't because those complaints are not made public. And now, be wary of going before a magistrate judge. These appointed judges rule on a variety of cases, but in some situations have a limited understanding and training on the law. They're not required to have law degrees. They aren't evaluated by lawmakers the same way other judges are. Several of them have been disciplined and remain on the bench. And there is lax oversight of these judges who are elected by state senators. These are some of the findings that Joey Cranny with the Post and Courier and in partnership with ProPublica has uncovered. Joey, welcome back to The Lead.
Thank you, Gavin.
Nice little bleak outlook there I outlined. Some of those stories that you actually worked on, the sheriffs acting above the law and the shielded world of judicial discipline. And now we're talking about magistrates.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to shine a light on some of the overlooked corners of South Carolina and particularly in criminal justice. I think that's been pretty good fodder for some investigative reporting this past year.
Definitely. And we'll be interested to see if there are any changes that come of it, you know, next year when lawmakers get back into session. I'm wondering what prompted this in-depth look specifically on the magistrates and what were some of the big takeaways that you found with your reporting on this project?
The thing that prompted it was just what I said. These are courtrooms that are positioned throughout South Carolina. There are more than 300 magistrates in the state. They're actually the busiest judges in the state. They handle more than a few hundred thousand cases every single year. If you've been to court in South Carolina, more likely than not, you've been before a magistrate judge, yet they receive very, very little public scrutiny. The courtrooms kind of don't look like what you think of as a typical courtroom. There's very few instances where lawyers are actually in there. Cops act as the prosecutors. Defendants often represent themselves. And the judges preside with very little of the traditional qualifications of the judge. For instance, 3/4 of the magistrates in South Carolina are not lawyers and have never practiced law in their lives. But the state allows them to preside over cases, everything from driving under the influence to petty theft to even like domestic violence cases. So these are very important public officials in South Carolina who seem to have very little scrutiny and oversight. So we thought it was important to set out to scrutinize these courts and highlight some of the misconduct that has taken place there over the past couple of decades, really.
So then what qualifications do these 319 magistrates need to have? I mean, are they also following typical sentencing guidelines, or what kind of goes down in that courtroom?
Right. So the Supreme Court says they do keep a close eye on magistrates, even if they're not hold little of the traditional qualifications of a judge. They have to follow the law, which has things like sentencing guidelines and has checklists for how to handle cases. And I think for the most part, it'd be fair to say that magistrates carry out the law in a fair way. But as we've seen time and time again, they've been disciplined or caught misapplying the law or committing other serious abuses. And one of the key findings of our story is that they take the bench having to do very little other than pass like a basic competency exam and undergoing about 57 hours of training, which is few hours of training than the state hands out to many other licensures in the state, including the state's barbers, the state's masseuses, the state's nail salon technicians. So we thought it was important to scrutinize the legal decisions they were making and highlight some of the abuses that have been uncovered over the years in light of the fact that, unlike many other states, South Carolina's magistrates are not lawyers and preside with a limited amount of qualifications.
Yeah, I think you said in your story that 28 states require a law degree in order to be a magistrate judge. And here we are talking about barbers having to have, you know, what, 1,000 or some hours to give you a haircut. You get a bad haircut, but that might last you 2 weeks, 3 weeks. You get a bad ruling from someone who doesn't know how to interpret the law. You talk about in your story this one woman who she was representing herself. She basically had a big fine that she couldn't pay and then was in jail and then lost her job, lost her house. I mean, like, it can spiral for certain people who are kind of on the fringe there.
Yeah, what lawyers and advocates say, and I think what our reporting shows, is when magistrates make judicial errors or misapply the law or deprive someone of their constitutional protections in court, it can have really, really serious consequences for people. Lexington County, near the state capital of Columbia, is currently a defendant in a federal lawsuit alleging that a magistrate judge there, Rebecca Adams, has basically systematically denied defendants their rights to due process, their rights to a court-appointed lawyer. And one of the cases we highlight in our story was the case of a woman who lived in Lexington County named Sasha Darby. She went to court over what I think would be fair to categorize as a pretty minor dispute. She got into a fight with her roommate. She says she hit her roommate in self-defense after her roommate kind of stepped to her in an argument at their house. But Judge Adams, in a hearing in Lexington County, did not ask Sasha if she wanted a court-appointed lawyer in the case where she couldn't actually afford to hire a lawyer herself. She was a low-income person in Lexington County. And the judge actually cut Sasha off when she was trying to make an argument in court that she was acting in self-defense. We have audio attached to our story that we obtained from the court hearing where the judge actually says, you know, so you did hit her. Why are we having this trial? Well, I shared that with two legal scholars, and they both said, no, Sasha actually had a right to defend herself. And if there was a lawyer in the courtroom that day, any lawyer would have pushed that.
It's a little bit more Judge Judy, Judge Joe Brown going on in here than it is, hey, let me hear you speak. Let me, you know, like a typical judge where, yes, they might interrupt a lawyer saying one thing or another thing, but to interrupt an actual defendant, like, yeah, you are infringing basically on their constitutional rights to defend themselves.
Yeah, I observed magistrate court hearings in courtrooms throughout the state, and I listened to court audio. It is such a stark difference than what I've observed in our circuit courts, where the judges have to be experienced lawyers before taking the bench, and they handle all of the state's major criminal and civil cases. In those instances, even when a defendant stands up and pleads guilty to a crime, it seems like a pretty straightforward hearing. The judge, the circuit judge, will engage that defendant in a very lengthy colloquy about what their legal rights are. They actually have to do that. They have to explain to them what their rights are, that they have the right to an attorney, they have the right to a jury trial, and they have to make a clear on-the-record waiver of all of those rights before proceeding. In magistrate's court, the defendants, almost all the time without lawyers, are brisked through these hearings, and they're kind of unwittingly being convicted of crimes that can have really, you know, serious impacts on their life.
I'm wondering, how are these magistrates viewed when it comes within the judicial profession and also from lawyers themselves?
I think, to be fair to the magistrate system, some people hold the view that they carry out an essential function in our justice system, which is the lower court system that handles, you know, the vast majority of cases and minor cases, everything from, like I said before, traffic tickets to minor civil disputes, including evictions. I think if you asked any lawyer or court official in South Carolina, they would acknowledge that if we tomorrow took the enormous caseload of magistrates' court and dumped it onto our circuit courts, the criminal justice system in South Carolina would effectively shut down. You need to have these some structure of a lower-tiered court to handle that bulk of cases. So in that case, they play a very important role in the system. The concerns come in who we are selecting to carry out those duties and the qualifications that we set for those people and the method that South Carolina uses to select those people.
Can't we maybe beef up requirements or at least have some sort of background in law enforcement? Some of these people might actually be retired police officers or law, like, you know, had gone through law school before. I know law school is not inexpensive, so you're doing that. Yeah, you know, it'd be nice to get a law degree. I'm not saying you have to be a barred lawyer necessarily, but, you know, you can at least have some background, some understanding within the field itself, not just maybe know a senator. I mean, that's essentially kind of how these guys and these men and women get appointed, is that they know, or, you know, in most cases, they're friends with a senator, family friend of a senator, state senator, who therefore appoints them, and then they get confirmed by voice vote in the Senate. I mean, that's a different appointment process than what we see, again, at the circuit court level.
We write in the story that magistrate appointments in South Carolina is a system that often places connections above qualifications. It's the only state in the country where state senators can handpick magistrates by themselves with very, very little scrutiny. This is a system that is more than 100 years old. Most states either have direct election of their lower court judges, or the chief executive, in most cases the governor, will appoint the judges. And they might have some kind of confirmation process in the legislative body. Think about how federal judges are appointed. The president will nominate them, and they'll get confirmed in the Senate. There's a kind of like a two-tiered check system. In South Carolina, they're actually supposed to be that system. In the state constitution, it says the governor selects magistrates with the advice and consent of the Senate. In practice, for more than a century, state senators select whoever they want to take the bench in their local counties. The candidate has to send some paperwork to the governor, but for a variety of reasons, the governor effectively acts as just a rubber stamp in that process and sends the names back to the Senate for a final confirmation, which, again, is a very little, not a very rigorous process and very different from how we elect the state's circuit and appellate court judges, which is a far more scrutinous and detailed process.
Yeah, they're going through the Judicial Merit Selection Committee. There's, you know, commission. There's a bunch of different paperwork that has come out. Yes, there's a lot of give and take and politics that go on, horse trading that goes on for how they are elected, but it is a more transparent process.
Well, they have to be experienced lawyers. Mm-hmm. They have to have, for the most part, they have, you know, extremely clean records. Mm-hmm. If you have a felony record, you can't be a circuit court judge in South Carolina. They are subject to public screenings by the Judicial Merit Selection Commission. Actually, this week in Columbia, they are screening our state's family court judges, which go before those screenings. And they have to submit very, very detailed disclosures to the state, which become public records. Magistrates are not selected like that. They have a standard two-page application form, which is used for any applicant for any board and commission in the state of South Carolina, where many really are not required to disclose some of the more potentially relevant details of their past. For instance, when they've been disciplined by the state agency that polices judges, our reporting found that magistrate judges in South Carolina are not required to disclose these disciplinary offenses in their record. And in fact, more than a dozen sitting magistrates preside and have been appointed despite this history of disciplinary action taken against them by the South Carolina's own arm of judicial enforcement.
But you found out you got the governor's office to say that they want that to be disclosed forth.
The governor's office was not even aware of that. There's a question on the application that magistrate applicants fill out. It asks if they had ever been disciplined by the State Ethics Commission. That is a commission that only applies to elected officials and lobbyists. It does not apply to judges. We have a totally separate agency for judges. It's called the Office of Disciplinary Counsel, which investigates complaints, and then the Commission on Judicial Conduct, which forwards suggestions for discipline to the Supreme Court. It is that separate process that is totally missed in these applications, and it has allowed candidates with disciplinary histories to slide through Columbia with virtually no questions asked about any potential issues.
Yeah, no, I was going to say you have some comments from some state senators in there about, I've never heard any negative complaints about this magistrate, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just wondering, you know, the average South Carolinian who's maybe going before one of these judges who, again, is, you know, doesn't even have enough money to get a lawyer, you know, isn't being briefed on their rights correctly. Like, I don't think they might know who their state senator is, let alone who else they would maybe want to complain to. So, you know, it's not like there's a centralized site or like someone you go to and say, oh, I don't think this judge, you know, was correct, or they might have made some off-color remarks from the bench during my hearing. Like, I'm just wondering, you know, they say, oh, I haven't heard any negative complaints. Well, how easy is it to even complain about a judge, let alone hear about these complaints?
It's understandable that if you appeared in magistrate court, you'd want to know if the judge you appeared before had any kind of unsavory or issue in their past or disciplinary action taken against them. For instance, in our reporting, we showed that several judges from the bench spewed racial slurs, sexist comments, and if I was a person of color or a woman, I'd like to know that before I appeared before a magistrate. To your point, If there was a process for filing a complaint against a magistrate and that's through the Office of Disciplinary Counsel, I think most people don't know exactly how that works. Mm-hmm. And most people who appear in magistrate courtrooms don't have lawyers with them who may be able to guide them through that process if there was a concern about the judge that they were appearing.
And how hard was it for you to find these complaints too?
They're tucked away in files in Columbia through the agency that keeps them, which is the Office of Disciplinary Counsel. We obtained, through the Freedom of Information Act, we obtained every disciplinary action taken against the magistrate over the past 20 years. And it may surprise people to learn that a lot of these issues, even though these actions were taken publicly, didn't get a lot of public attention. Mm. It was kind of striking in my reporting that when I was calling senators to ask them about magistrates that they appointed who had a disciplinary history, I informed them several times that an action had been taken against one of their own judges. It seems even the senators are kept in the dark. Mm-hmm. When the state agency that polices judges takes an action against them, which can include, you know, just a verbal warning, but it can also include suspensions. There are sitting judges, sitting magistrates in South Carolina that have been suspended. And some of the senators who appointed those judges didn't even know that until we told them.
And so kind of going forward, we did hear that you you know, the governor's office wants those disciplinary actions disclosed going forward. Do they have to make that to pass a bill for any of that stuff to happen, or is that something that can just
I think the governor has the authority to require whatever application he or she may want. We should acknowledge how limited the governor's role is in this, though. One of the issues that we gleaned in our reporting was that even if the governor had a serious issue with a magistrate candidate, their decision to try to block that nomination would likely come at a political cost because senators really, for decades, have coveted this power to appoint judges in their areas. We talked to former Governor Jim Hodges, who told us if he were to take a public issue with a magistrate candidate, he would effectively be threatening to thwart whatever legislative priorities he had that year. For the most part, people just leave local appointments up to whoever senator it is who decides it. And if you don't get involved in that senator's appointment, he won't get involved in your appointment. And that's pretty much been the way magistrate judges have been selected in South Carolina for years and years.
So, yeah, need to see some action coming. I guess if it has to come from anywhere, it has to come from those 46 senators and the state legislature. Interesting, Joe. And then, of course, just really quick, you had a separate piece on former Representative Mike Pitts, State Rep Mike Pitts, who resigned as a representative earlier this year, had a failed attempt to try and run the state conservation bank, but then also all of a sudden became a magistrate judge kind of last minute there in the ending days of the session.
There's few people in Columbia over the past few years more controversial than Mike Pitts. He was a very staunch defender of the Confederate flag in the effort after the Charleston AME shooting when state leaders took the flag down from the state house grounds. More recently, he retired after a 13-year term as a lawmaker and then tried to get a job running the state's conservation bank. This led to criticism that he as a former cop, wasn't necessarily qualified for that, and there were some accusations that this was just a political favor that lawmakers were doing for their old buddy. So when his name came across the local appointments list for this new application he sent as a magistrate, you would think that someone with such a recent history in Columbia would have caused some concern and maybe some pushback. But the problem is no one even knew that he had applied to be a magistrate just because of the nature of the process. He applied to be a magistrate in his home county of Lawrence, where just a single senator presides. So all Mike Pitts needed to do to become a magistrate, really, was get the support of his local senator, who happens to be a former Republican colleague of his, and that's Senator Danny Verdin. So Mike Pitts' application as magistrate, like many others over the years, slid through Columbia, no questions asked. And it was only after the local appointments list was published that some senators realized they had just unwittingly confirmed Mike Pitts.
And then you guys found some questionable posts on his Facebook page as well that could, you had some quotes from some people saying that it could jeopardize his ability to be impartial while he rules.
Yeah, I think in line with his controversial political views on Facebook, he made some quite offensive comments toward people of color, some xenophobic comments toward immigrants and Muslims, and some seriously transphobic comments. He suggested in a post that people who identify as transgender women should be forced to play male sports and wrote that, quote, they aren't sure what the hell they are. He wrote that Senator Cory Booker, he posted a photo of him and wrote that Booker always looks like he, quote, hit crack real hard. He railed against some people who he had an interaction with in Walmart, described them as people from the Middle East, and said after that incident, he then, quote, supports shutting down all immigration to stop, quote, the demise of our culture. So we just reviewed Mike Pitts' Facebook posts and found all of those things. Now, for anyone who knows Mike Pitts, it might not be surprising that he wrote some of those things, but what we talk to lawmakers about is that judges are held to much, much higher standards. They actually have strict judicial ethics laws requiring them to avoid making comments that would make it seem like they were not fair or impartial toward the people who appear before them. We actually spoke to Gary Clary, Representative Clary, who is a former circuit judge, who said those kinds of things might be grounds for recusal for people of color or transgender people or anyone else who appears in front of Mike Pitts and might feel like he, because of his biases, might not give them a fair hearing.
And without your reporting, we wouldn't have known those things, Joey, so we appreciate you bringing such details and important news to light, especially when it comes to our judicial system here in South Carolina. Thank you, Joey Carani and ProPublica, for that recent report.
Thanks, Gavin.
having a hard time getting back to work this week. It's okay. You know why? Because we got some campaign trail. Everyone look under your seats because there's campaign trail there. It's everywhere. You can't get off it. No one's ever getting off the campaign trail. Oh, sorry. Gotta get back to work here. It's that time again for some campaign trail news updates. We're looking at the latest in 2020 related movements affecting South Carolina, state campaign news, and highlights from the state's congressional delegation. Leading off, the Aiken Standard reports that Representative Joe Wilson believes that the deep state played a sizable role in shuttering the mixed oxide fuel fabrication facility, an incomplete nuclear fuel project that was canceled after more than a decade of work and billions of dollars had been invested. The MOX project at the Savannah River site had been scrutinized for years before President Donald Trump entered office and was eventually terminated last October. The Post and Courier reports that Republican Kathy Landing had a 30-second spot air during the South Carolina Clemson game as she seeks to introduce herself and differentiate herself in a field of five Republicans angling to be the first congressional district nominee to challenge Democrat Joe Cunningham. The ad buy cost $4,500 on ESPN, per the Federal Communications Commission. The state newspaper reports that President Donald Trump's campaign arm and the Republican Finance Committee announced that Governor Henry McMaster and former governor and ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley will help co-lead Trump's South Carolina team ahead of the November general election. Also joining the team are the seven Republican members of the state congressional delegation, and Jason Simmons will serve as Trump's regional director, and Bill Stern will serve as state finance chair. Montana Governor Steve Bullock and former Representative Joe Sestak are the most recent Democrat candidates to nix their presidential bids, bringing the field to 16. And just topping off that, filing ends Wednesday for candidates wishing to appear on the 2020 South Carolina Democratic presidential primary ballot. Get those names in soon, guys, and we'll see you on February 29th. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure that lawmakers use when speaking to each other. And did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is here with some state trivia for us? He is. Russ, welcome. Heard you had a great
Thanks.
Thanksgiving.
Glad to be back. Low-key, but great.
There you go. I hear you. What do you have for us today?
Well, you know, we talk an awful lot about history on these Did You Knows, and that's because there's so much history in this little state.
Yes.
And there are dozens and dozens, in fact, there are actually hundreds and hundreds of historic sites in this state. There are literally hundreds of sites across the state that are on the National Register of Historic Places. But did you know that one entire city or town in South Carolina, the entire entity, the entire city or town is designated as a National Historic Place, which I guess would make it the most historic city or town in the state.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about Charleston.
Oh, take that, Charleston. I know, thank God.
So your choices the most historic town or city in the state: A, Pendleton; B, Abbeville; C, Camden; D, York.
I wasn't really paying attention because I was hoping you'd say 96, and I'd be like, 96.
Pendleton, Abbeville, Camden, York.
I like Camden. I'm just going to like...
Entire city or town is
on
the...
I just like Camden, you know? You know, besides, you know, the whole like, you're going to get a speeding ticket on 20 in Kershaw County. You know, Camden's good stuff there. Get downtown. You're...
So going with Camden.
Yeah, I mean, that's just my... Just instinct right there, not knowing really.
Well, the correct answer is A, Pendleton.
I had a feeling because I never even think about Pendleton.
The entire town of Pendleton, it's in Anderson County, northwest Anderson County, is encompassed in the Pendleton District. That entire district is on the National Register of Historic Places, one of the very largest in the country, of about a million properties that have that official government historic designation. That area, of course, originally was part of the Cherokee Indian lands. Then it became Pendleton District. A lot of interaction back and forth there during the Revolutionary War with the Indians and the Patriots, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, Pendleton is right next to Clemson, the town of Clemson, the city of Clemson, and Clemson University. You may have heard of them as well.
Yeah, it's always interesting to see how that becomes a thing, because I know in some places, I'm thinking of downtown Florence, I know a lot of their buildings are historic, but Of course, the whole district isn't necessarily historic. I mean, I guess they do rip it in, but I'm guessing it's smaller than when you look at something like Pendleton.
So Pendleton could make a claim for South Carolina's most historic town.
I can already hear the monocles shattering south of Broad right now. Well, thank you, Russ. We appreciate it.
Okay.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on scetv.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Friday at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday at 11:30 a.m. All about this podcast and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and southcarolinapublicradio.org. Subscribe to us and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Also, be sure to rate and review us on iTunes. Follow us on Instagram at @scleadpod, and you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at @scleadpod. We have swag, sticker swag that is, also a really great gift. If you need something for this Christmas, a good stocking stuffer, send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send some stickers your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on December 2nd, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message. Elf on the Shelf is cruel and unusual punishment for the elf and parents.
Send all personal identifying information to lead @1041 George Rogers Boulevard.